This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Concussions and sports. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us, and here's what's coming up this hour.
The challenges facing parents today as they debate whether and when to let their kids compete in contact sports.
On the money front, credit unions have some newfound financial swagger. Find out how they're using it.
A new survey finds 80% of Americans find politics to be their top source of stress. How can it be better managed?
And Disney finds that pleasing Star Wars fans is no easy task.
I have to say, it is very intense. I've rarely reported a story where emotions ran so high as they do among Star Wars fans and what they think or how they think Disney is handling the franchise since they bought Lucasfilm.
Eric Schwartzel at the Wall Street Journal on Disney disturbing the force, as he calls it. Matthew Benedict, a former athlete at Middlebury College, is not the first athlete who played contact sports who took his own life. He is also not the first 20-something to struggle with mental health problems. But his story illustrates the challenges parents face as they decide whether to let their sons and daughters play contact sports, as well as deciphering conflicting messages from scientists and sports leagues about head trauma. An in-depth look at concussions from Nancy Armour, columnist at USA Today Sports. Nancy set this up.
This is a story about Matthew Benedict, who played basically all contact sports growing up, football, hockey, lacrosse. He was a standout player at Middlebury College. And in July, he committed suicide. He jumped off the 17th floor of a building where he was working. And his parents, while his brain was not able to be tested for CTE, his parents believe that he had it. And they think that it was the culmination of hits that he took over his years of playing contact sports. And when he died, he was only 26, 6 weeks shy of his 27th birthday.
What I thought was interesting in your story, too, and I guess perhaps disappointing from a medical standpoint, is that CTE can only be diagnosed during an autopsy.
Yes, and that is one of the things, you know, there still is so much about CTE that we don't know. You know, most researchers will say that there is a link between repetitive head trauma and CTE. Exactly what the link is, they're still trying to find out. And part of that is going to be finding a living diagnosis. And researchers think that they're getting closer, but they're still not there yet. And until we have that, we can't answer other questions like, is somebody predisposed? What role does genetics play? Can alcohol and drug use, if there is any, accelerate the progression of the disease? There's still a lot that we need to find out, and getting a living diagnosis is key to pretty much all of those questions.
Boy, and it's disappointing too, I guess, that there's still a stigma attached to this, as I guess the Benedicts found out, right?
Yes, Matthew wrote a very personal essay a couple days after he graduated from Middlebury, and he had been struggling with mental health issues since his junior season, which his parents believe is tied to a game when he had two really hard hits, and they believe that he had post-concussion syndrome as a result. But he wrote this essay and just really very openly and very honestly talked about the issues that he'd had, his feelings of being a failure, he talked about a couple of times that whether they were officially suicide attempts or just, you know, whatever it was, he was open about it. And while some people praised him for it, there were other people who were saying, man, you shouldn't be writing stuff like this. You know, whether it's the criticism of the school or a suggestion that the school could have been doing more to address mental health or just not, you know, suggesting that he shouldn't put it out there because the future employers might see it.
Wow.
And his parents said after that, he really withdrew, that he, you know, he hid his struggles with mental illness so that people would not, if you didn't know him well, you wouldn't have known that anything was wrong.
Hmm. We're speaking with Nancy Armour, columnist at USA Today Sports. She's written a powerful piece entitled Concussions and Contact Sports, What These Parents Learned from Their Son's Death. What struck me too was what seemed like a sudden change in personality for Mr. Benedict. What is it, the age of 21, right, where he came home one Christmas break and he normally the life of the Christmas spirit and was completely removed.
Yeah, and his parents said it was very, very, very marked that he would withdraw from the family. His mom said that oftentimes she'd go upstairs past his room and she'd see him just sitting on his bed staring. And she said that wasn't her son. And he told his sister that he had been in a funk for more than a month. So it developed rapidly. And they worked mightily to get him help. But, you know, unfortunately, this is an insidious disease, and until we start bringing it into the light, I think we're going to have stories like this.
For the parents of Mr. Benedict, I don't want to say their message is, or guess what their message is, that it might be like, don't play contact sports. What do they say?
I think their message is twofold. They both say that if they had to do it over again, their boys would not have played sports with a helmet, contact sports, at the ages that they did. You know, they started playing when they were 6 and 7 years old.
Okay.
And it's not just football. That's one of the big takeaways from the story, is that it is not just football that people need to be concerned about, but also too, the Benedicts want to remove the stigma, especially among young people, that they, you know, that they are free to, if they are struggling, that they are free to go and seek help, or that they will approach somebody, that they won't feel that they need to hide the issues that they're having, and that they can go and talk to somebody.
Thanks, Nancy. Nancy Armour, columnist at USA Today Sports. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Did your last bottle of cologne come from the grocery store? Now you smell like your dad? Hi there, Gordon Deal. To solve your dad cologne problems, let me introduce you to Hawthorne. Trust me, this cologne smells amazing. Go to hawthorne.co and take their quick quiz and find out the two colognes that are best for you. One for work, maybe one for play. This quiz is really cool. It took me 2 minutes and was very specific. They were able to tailor products for me that were perfect for my needs. From colognes to body wash, shampoos, and more. Take the quiz now and get started. I only usually wear cologne when I receive it as a gift, but the Hawthorne cologne now has me thinking differently. Same for body wash. I typically grab whatever from the grocery store. But the exfoliating wash from Hawthorne is next level stuff. Check out Hawthorne at hawthorne.co. That's Hawthorne with an E. And use my promo code Gordon to get 10% off your first purchase. That's Hawthorne.co. And use my promo code Gordon to get 10% off your purchase. Hawthorne.co. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. U.S. politics have never felt quite as contemptuous and unavoidable as they do today. Now a new survey of 2,000 Americans finds that all of this vitriol-filled political discourse is taking a serious mental toll. An astounding 78% of respondents say politics is the number one source of anxiety and stress in their life. Why? And how can we better manage it? We're joined now by Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist. Doctor, what's happened here?
Well, I think what's happened is, you know, we switched over from a 24-hour news cycle to pretty much a 15-minute news cycle because of the way the old subscription-based news outlets are now run. You don't get subscriptions. They get paid through click-throughs. So they lead with very dramatic bullet point leads on their social media. People click on it. And the whole idea is that they know they get a response when they stimulate that emotional response of anger. And they get that click-through. That keeps their funding going. And they stay open. But I think it's really having a detrimental effect on the psyche of America.
If it bleeds, it leads, right? I mean, that's still
Absolutely.
A thing. I mean, figuratively here, it may be the case, right? But the sensational or whatever seems to get people's attention.
Absolutely. And it's kind of scary in a lot of ways because I don't think, you know, when I talk to people on the street, when I talk to my clients, when I talk to other physicians, they're not reading the story. So the story may not be changing at all. They're just reading the bullet points. And they're allowing that to get their dander up, and they get upset and angry. And, you know, we are in a body that reacts fight-or-flight kind of mechanism.
Yeah.
And when we get emotionally upset, our forebrain actually has blood flow directed away from it to the limbic system. So we stop thinking clearly, and we start reacting emotionally. And my concern is, how is that affecting people, for example, when they're driving down the road on the highway? Are they no longer thinking thoughtfully about what's going on and maybe reacting emotionally for everything?
Boy, I'm not necessarily following all your science of blood flow there, but I mean, could that also be the reason we get stress headaches?
Absolutely. You get tension headaches. That has to do with blood flow in a different part of your body. You know, when a bear crosses your pathway, your extremities get flooded with blood so that they have more energy to run away from that bear. But what happens is our other core features, like our digestion, that gets slowed down, because if you don't get away, it doesn't matter if your food's digested or not. And that's kind of what's happening inside your brain. But that also shifts that periphery blood flow, and that can give you the stress headaches, definitely. Yeah.
We're speaking with Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist, also chairman of a nonprofit called Mainstream Mental Health. We're talking about 8 in 10 Americans saying politics are the biggest source of stress in life. So compare that number over the years to, say, what is it, 51% say things at the office stress us out. Which are those numbers consistent, like over the decades, or is politics way worse than it used to be in terms of a stressor?
Politics is way worse than it used to be. You know, it used to be work and money, and then family issues used to be the top three. And then we run into health issues and things like that. Now it's politics, and it's clearly a 25-30 point increase over the next stressor, which was 51% of work stressors. And that's a pretty scary thing. Again, we don't know what the long-term effects of this are going to be. And I think what we're seeing now is a lot of people turning off from politics. They're just tired of it.
How can we be better managers of this type of stress if we recognize that it's starting to come on?
One of the first things you can do is just turn off the data stream on your cell phone, on your portable device. I recommend with my patients, they take a week off. There's some real simple apps you can get, the ones that you use to monitor your children with, and just put it on your phone and control it and shut down that so your phone is actually a phone for the week. And then I recommend one day a week taking a vacation from all that data. And that kind of keeps you centered. It doesn't do enough one day a week to make you feel like you've missed the whole world. That week that you're off can be kind of disturbing. The first 3 or 4 days tend to be really difficult. I tried this myself about a year ago. I took actually 8 weeks off, and it was pretty amazing.
Sounds amazing. Thanks, John. Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist. It is 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business, but you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
At the movies, the highly anticipated Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker is now in theaters. But it appears that Disney has had a difficult time absorbing the blockbuster series. Part of that is how to bring aboard a new generation of moviegoers while avoiding turning off the diehard fans that have an outsized voice in the success or failure of the films. More from Eric Schwartzel, film industry reporter at the Wall Street Journal, who says the worrying has begun. Eric, sounds intense.
I have to say, it is very intense. I've rarely reported a story where emotions ran so high as they do among Star Wars fans, and what they think, or how they think, Disney is handling the franchise since they bought Lucasfilm in 2012. We've now had 4 movies come out since that acquisition, and then the 5th, and arguably the most important one, that's The Rise of Skywalker, which is said to be the conclusion of the trilogy that started, you know, back in 1977 with George Lucas.
So what is it that do Star Wars fans not trust the way Disney will create a Star Wars film?
Some don't. And I think one thing I learned on reporting this story is that Star Wars has always been a franchise with characters and storylines that can very quickly get very political. Even back in the 70s and 80s, I was told that when The Empire Strikes Back opened, members of Jews for Jesus would stand outside the theater with pamphlets because they thought that the movie was an endorsement of their religion. So there's always been this kind of proxy debate going on with Star Wars movies, but that has been amplified in the age of social media. And some of the more recent films have seen themselves become the subject of debates, whether it's about, sort of certain gender roles or even animal rights. LGBT representation. There's been a bit of a sea change in what audiences expect a movie this big to look like. They want to see certain kinds of representation on screen that go beyond having three white leads like Carrie Fisher, Harrison Ford, and Mark Hamill. But what has happened is, as Disney has been trying to cast for a global marketplace, some of those people who have grown up with the original films have said, wait, this doesn't look like or feel like the Star Wars I grew up with. And there's a real sense of ownership in the Star Wars fan community because people have grown up with this franchise.
Yeah. We're speaking with Eric Schwartzel, film industry reporter at The Wall Street Journal. He's written a piece entitled "Disney Disturbs the Force, Pleasing Star Wars Fans Complicates Saga." You wrote, too, that the Star Wars business so far has been good for Disney, but I got the sense there was a however in there.
There is. Certainly, we can't argue that the movies are making a lot of money. Some are making more than others, of course. The Force Awakens, which was the first movie done after the acquisition, is still the highest grossing movie at the U.S. box office in history. But other films have underwhelmed or even disappointed. Solo, which was a spinoff about the early days of Han Solo, it made $200 million. Now, most movies would be happy to make about $200 million at the box office, but not a Star Wars film. That was considered a real disappointment. And there also, I think, what I was trying to get at in the piece are larger existential questions facing the franchise. We don't know what's going to happen after this movie comes out. The CEO of Disney, Bob Iger, has said that he plans to hit pause and put the franchise on a bit of a hiatus as they try and recalibrate. And I think that the other question will be, how exactly do these movies age? The movies that came out starting in 1977 are classics that people watch over and over and over again. Mm. I spoke to a number of people, not only executives from within Disney and Lucasfilm, but also fans themselves, who said, I question whether or not the product that's being produced right now, well-received as it may be, is going to sort of meet that impossible standard.
Wow. What about the pace of movies? I know Mr. Iger said he's going to hit pause, but has the pace of movies played a role?
I think it's been a huge issue. Soon after the acquisition went forward, Disney really put Lucasfilm into hyperdrive, and they started putting out essentially one movie a year, and in one case they put out two movies within like 6 months of each other. The Last Jedi came out in December, and then Solo came out in the following May. And they quickly learned that the marketplace, even though it can sustain a pretty saturated rotation of Marvel movies or Pixar movies, that for whatever reason, Star Wars does not operate that way, and that people like a pause and an ability to catch their breath. And so that initial metabolism is going to be drastically slowed.
Thanks, Eric. Eric Schwartzel, film industry reporter at The Wall Street Journal. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, what's new at brokerage firms? Also, how to give the gift of a better job this Christmas, and a heartwarming dog adoption story. We'll have that in about 20 minutes. Credit unions, long seen as a humdrum corner of consumer finance, are going toe-to-toe now with the biggest financial institutions. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Credit union or bank? When it comes to consumer finance, credit unions have become all the rage lately. Here to explain why is Ben Eisen of the Wall Street Journal. Ben, define what are some of the different things between credit unions and banks? What makes them different?
Well, a credit union is fundamentally different in the fact that it is a not-for-profit institution. So when it earns profits, it reinvests them back into the institution. And as a result, it often lowers interest rates on loans or offers higher interest on deposits. So the fundamental model is a bit different. And because of that, they are exempt from federal taxes.
Credit unions in the past seem to be built for a specific kind of person. Has that changed?
In some ways. They have expanded very rapidly over the last decade or so and gotten into all sorts of different types of businesses, whether it's expanding in auto loans or getting into loans for recreational vehicles like boats and RVs, or getting into cannabis banking. All these different things have sort of expanded, and as credit unions have grown, they have they've sort of broadened their reach, and sort of the element that binds people who belong to credit unions has really sort of broadened over the course of time. They were sort of built around the idea of a common bond, meaning all the members of a credit union, you know, they work for the same company, live in the same town, or, you know, have a unique binding characteristic. And that sort of loosened really over the last 50 or so years.
Ben, why are they growing so rapidly? Is it because they have better rates for customers?
I mean, there are a number of factors at play here. One of them is, you know, after the financial crisis, people became disenchanted with banks. And, you know, there were a fair number of people that chose credit unions as an alternative. They've also really competed aggressively. Part of that is offering low rates on loans and other products. Also just kind of advertising, getting the word out, and really kind of expanding into new markets. Another factor is that they really, you know, after the financial crisis, regulators really took a hands-on approach to regulating banks and really cracked down. And credit unions, which really weren't at the center of the financial crisis, regulators took more of a hands-off approach. And because of that, they have a bit more latitude to expand and broaden their reach.
We're speaking with Ben Eisen of The Wall Street Journal. Ben, are there concerns about their rapid growth?
You know, it's something that sort of remains to be seen. So you have credit unions these days that are as big as large banks, $80, $90, $100 billion in assets. And, you know, credit unions at that size have not been through a major recession. And so there are questions about, you know, are the regulations strong enough? Are there worries about concentration among certain loan types with these credit unions? Could that pose a risk down the road? And, you know, it's tough to know at the moment, but, you know, there are people who are concerned about it.
Now, Ben, credit unions pay no federal income tax. Do the banks feel that that's an unfair advantage for them?
So this is a very longstanding battle that banks and credit unions have had for, you know, decades at this point. Banks claim that credit unions sort of have an unfair leg up because they don't pay federal income taxes. They're able to sort of compete more aggressively, and it's harder for banks to keep up. And credit unions, they say, well, we have a model that's fundamentally in the public interest, and we deserve this tax exemption. So it's sort of one of these battles that has been around forever and probably shows no signs of going away.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Eisen. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. The price war among financial companies has clearly moved on, with some firms eliminating brokerage commissions in 2019 or touting the highest interest rate paid by their brokerage cash account. Cutting index fund expenses is, it seems, so last year. So says personal finance expert Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Where does that leave investors? Jonathan, explain.
Yeah, we had a stretch there where a lot of the major mutual fund companies and providers of exchange-traded index funds were involved in this price-cutting war. And in a sense, it came to its logical conclusion in the middle of last year when Fidelity Investments introduced 4 index funds with 0 expenses. After that, well, you can't really do much better than 0, right? And since that's happened, you know, we've had other funds brought out with, you know, very low expenses, but the price war among financial companies has moved on. You know, there's been a lot of talk about 0 trading commissions among the discount brokerage firms. There's been talk about, you know, what's the yield that you get on your brokerage sweep cash account where you keep the cash before you trade with it. So that's where the financial firms are battling it out now, and this whole area of index fund fees seems to have quieted down.
All right, so when companies introduce the 0 fees on certain funds, I mean, they're not giving money away. Where are they making up the difference?
Well, so a couple of things are going on. First of all, funds make a little bit of extra money from something called securities lending. So they can lend out the securities in the fund to, say, people who want to short sell the stock. So funds can make a little bit of money that way to offset, you know, the fact that they might be offering these funds at 0 or close to 0 cost. But much more important than that, these are essentially loss leaders. When Schwab or Fidelity introduce index funds with really, really low expenses, what they're banking on is that people may buy those low-cost index funds, but they're also going to buy other products which have really fat profit margins, and that's where they're going to make up the money.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's written a piece entitled Low Blows, which talks about what's new with financial companies and their fees. One of the things you point out in your story, and you and I have talked about this over the course of the years, point number two, costs don't always drive performance, meaning essentially you might be paying a fee, but that doesn't guarantee you're going to make out great on a fund, right?
Right. So take these four zero-cost index funds that Fidelity introduced. Two of them, four, have actually tracked their indexes pretty closely, but the other two, a smaller cap fund and an international index fund, have not tracked their indexes very closely at all. The gap has been really quite substantial in the brief time these funds have been around, and that on Wall Street is known as tracking error. So if you buy a fund, yeah, by all means, look and see what the expenses are, and everything else being equal, you want to favor the fund with the lowest expenses. But also look at those index funds and say, how closely have they tracked their index? And if they haven't tracked their index closely, there's a risk there that your performance going forward may not be nearly as good as you imagine, not because the fees are high, but because the fund simply doesn't track its index particularly well.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Did your last bottle of cologne come from the grocery store? Now you smell like your dad? Hi there, Gordon Deal. To solve your dad cologne problems, let me introduce you to Hawthorne. Trust me, this cologne smells amazing. Go to hawthorne.co and take their quick quiz and find out the two colognes that are best for you. One for work, maybe one for play. This quiz is really cool. It took me 2 minutes and was very specific. They were able to tailor products for me that were perfect for my needs. From colognes to body wash, shampoos, and more. Take the quiz now and get started. I only usually wear cologne when I receive it as a gift, but the Hawthorne cologne now has me thinking differently. Same for body wash. I typically grab whatever from the grocery store, but the exfoliating wash from Hawthorne is next level stuff. Check out Hawthorne at hawthorne.co. That's Hawthorne with an E. And use my promo code Gordon to get 10% off your first purchase. That's HAWTHORNE.co. And use my promo code Gordon to get 10% off your purchase. Hawthorne.co. Thanks for being with us. More workers are moving away from traditional employment altogether thanks to the rise of the gig economy and freelancing. How do you give a gift to those workers, though, during the holidays? MarketWatch has put together some recommendations from career experts on gifts you can give friends and family to help them move up at work or perhaps strike out on their own in the gig economy. Here's reporter Jacob Passy. Jacob, help us out.
The nature of work is changing quite a bit. You know, more people are freelancing, more people are working in the gig economy. Also, you know, right now the labor market is really strong, which is great. You know, it's not necessarily hard to find a job, but that's all the reason why, you know, a lot of folks are probably looking for a job now is, you know, that it's a job seeker's market right now. And so certain gifts that you can give folks can help them with their job search and get them into a better position.
All right. So one of the ones you suggest it was helping a friend or colleague, say, improve their public speaking and other soft skills. How so?
Yeah, so, you know, these are skills that come up in the job search process, right? You know, you're going to get interviewed probably, you might have to give a presentation, you know. So it's good to brush up on those skills, and those are the sorts of skills that are increasingly distinguishing people in the jobs market, you know. As more and more roles are automated, it's about, you know, the softer skills, the people-to-people interaction, things like that. So the suggestions I got from career coaches, one was, you know, kind of the tried and true enrolling in a class with Toastmasters International. They're a nonprofit that promotes speaking skills and public speaking. So they have, you know, classes across the country. You could help pay for your friend or loved one's membership fees and get them enrolled in a class. But there are also unconventional routes you can go. One suggestion I loved was taking an improv class or paying for them to take an improv class. Helps you think on your feet. That's really good for, you know, the interviews when you get that kind of oddball question out of nowhere and you don't want to mess up in front of the person who's hiring you. You know, having improv skills can be a huge help. Plus, it's fun.
We're speaking with Jacob Passy, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. He's written a piece entitled How to Give Someone a Better Career for Christmas. All right, so how about when it comes to boosting their digital presence? What does that mean?
So back even today, to some extent, but certainly, a decade ago or so, there was so much focus placed on the resume. So resume services were a popular gift you could give folks. Today, it's all about LinkedIn. Lots of people probably have LinkedIn profiles, but, there are ways you can enrich your LinkedIn presence. I liked the quote from one person I spoke with. She said, "We approach LinkedIn as a virtual billboard." So, it's not just a matter of regurgitating your resume onto your LinkedIn profile. They should serve different purposes. LinkedIn should be a bit more of a living, breathing thing. You should be updating it on the go. If you produce projects that are published or anything like that, there are ways of adding multimedia to LinkedIn. Beyond that, website, a personal website is huge. And especially this gets to, the folks who are freelancing or self-employed. It's really important for a lot of those folks to have their own website.
Finish up with finding folks free time so they can focus on their career.
Yeah, so this comes down to, especially for freelancers, one of the big challenges is, the division between, life and work and, carving out time to do errands, chores, things like that, because, you can easily, as a freelancer, be working, every waking hour. You don't have the traditional 9-to-5. It's a blessing and the curse.
All right, thanks, Jacob. Jacob Passy, reporter at MarketWatch. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. And you can follow me directly on Twitter as well at Gordon Deal.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for being with us. There's no place like home for the holidays, especially for one longtime shelter dog who was finally adopted after a 500-day wait. Last week, a 5-year-old pit bull mixed named Bonita went home with her new owner after living at the Niagara County SPCA in Niagara Falls, New York, for over a year and a half. Fox 13 Television says the pup was the shelter's longest-term resident. No surprise. SPCA officials felt Bonita belonged in a home with no kids or other dogs, plus lots of one-on-one attention. Requisites that ultimately proved tough to match, according to puppy blog DogSpot. Bonita's luck changed when Ray Kins visited the shelter and instantly fell in love with the cute mutt. Last Thursday, the pooch got the fairy tale ending she deserved and left the shelter for good. In now viral footage shared by the Niagara SPCA to Facebook, the rescue dog received a grand escort out of the building. Proudly held on a leash by her new dad, Bonita joyfully jumped and ran down the pathway, awash in confetti, in a feel-good clip that has gone viral. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.